Hi, collaborists. I'm Ben Leroy.
And I'm Jason Buchholz.
Welcome to Collaboracast.
What do we have going on today, Ben?
Well, you know, one thing I just wanted to do publicly is thank you for making the time to keep this podcast being fresh and original week after week. I have started so many podcasts in my life that are really solid for like the first episode or two. And then I kind of lose track of keeping things going on an orderly basis over there at the old Ben Leroy Show podcast. Go ahead, check that out if you haven't already, people. But you've been juggling sick children, a move, all of this stuff. And you are there and you are the perfect accountability partner to make sure that all of this stuff gets done. So I just wanted to publicly thank you for that.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure to be a part of this and to watch it grow and evolve. And I think it helps when we've got so many awesome people around us to chat with as well.
Yeah. So we are indeed blessed to have a lot of really rad people around us today on the podcast. I had a chance to do an interview with, it's interesting because sometimes I would call her Carolyn Lee Adams. Sometimes I would call her Carrie Adams. With my friend Carolyn / Carrie, who is one of our original collaborists. She's an author, a graduate of the USC Film School, stand-up comedian, one of the best storytellers I know. So I'm looking forward to people hearing that interview. It's a good reminder when you hear Carrie talking about the work that she's done with her own creative work, but also the time that she has spent doing editing, doing ghostwriting. She's currently leading one of the Collaborist writers groups, and she talks about that in there. And she also reminds people that if they want to join that group, it has started already, but she will continue to accept people until, I believe she said April 8th, but I'm not completely sure about that, but somewhere around there.
Yep, April 8th it was.
Okay. You know, that's a reminder that we've got an amazing collection of writers and editors and coaches and people who have lived in experience in the storytelling realm who are available to hire as part of what Collaborist does, and that our free programming that we provide to the community is made possible by the jobs that we're doing to edit and lead groups and do pop-up writers workshops in the future.
I really enjoyed listening to this conversation because I'm getting to know, you know, as we came together to build this, you've got a network. We've obviously know some people. We have some friends in common, some colleagues in common, but there are people that you've brought into this that I don't know and vice versa. And for me, it was just, it's great getting to know your network, getting to know these people and to hear her story and all that she's done and been through, and to just kind of hear the opportunity that is there for somebody who wanted to come in and work with somebody who knows script writing or somebody who is trying to build out a set for a stand-up comic. You know, it was cool for me to learn that we can offer those things.
Yeah, absolutely. And these are all just manifestations of storytelling and how we get out the stories that we want to tell.
All right. Well, let's hear your conversation.
All right. Looking forward to it. When did we first meet?
The first time we met in person or the first time we met online?
Online. When did we interact for the first time? Oh.
So you were blogging for, I think it was called There's a Dead Guy in My Living Room.
Yeah.
And I had newly switched from writing screenplays to writing novels. And I wanted to learn about how to write a novel, how that whole process worked, how you got published. And so I came across that blog, and you quickly became my favorite aspect of that blog. And I would look forward to your, I think you posted like on Wednesdays or something. Anyway, so I would look forward to it. I'm like, oh man, it's Ben's day. Cause every, that blog had a different contributor for each day of the week. And the thing that you wrote that really struck me was a thing about why I hate your villain. And it was like a 10-point list of like kind of like trite, you know what I mean? Like stereotypical problems. And I read that list and I was like, oh no, that perfectly describes my villain. Like it was like you had reached into my manuscript and read it. And I could see that, I could see my villain reflected in every single point. And I was like, this is the guy who can help me, because you had already known exactly what was wrong with my manuscript. And you put out this offer that if somebody donated $500 to this particular charity, and to be honest, I can't even remember what the charity.
I think my friend Sabrina was having jaw surgery.
Oh, yes.
And I would have never remembered that, except something just shook loose when you said that.
Yes, yes, yes. So, and I didn't have $500, and I was also in a marriage that wasn't doing well. And even though my husband made, I was working part-time at that point, and not earning very much, but my husband was earning perfectly good money. And I was like, hey, I need $500 because I want to win this critique so badly. Like I need this guy to read my manuscript so badly. And he was like, you're going to have to figure it out on your own. And so I went up into the attic and I got all of my Transformers from my childhood. And I sold my Transformers for the $500. And so that's how I paid for your critique. And so that was like, you know, I reached out to you and that was arranged. But then we both, that this was 2011. And to be honest, I'm not really sure what you had going on. I know exactly what I had going on, which was, no, I'm so sorry. This is 2012.
Yeah, it was 2012. So,
2012. I don't know what you had going on, but I know that like I was involved in basically my marriage falling apart. And so you kept saying like, you know, give me a little more time and then I can critique the manuscript. And I'm like, listen, don't worry about it. Like, don't worry about it. I'm very, very busy. And I also thought to myself, like, I'm going to be completely honest with you, Ben, and I don't think I've ever told you this before. I was like kind of excited for it to keep delaying because I thought to myself, I can get the whole book written. Because at the time it was a critique of 50 pages. I'm like, I can get the whole book written. And by the time that this actually happens, this guy's going to feel so guilty that he's going to read the whole book.
Well played.
And it did. It played out
exactly
like that. So by the end, I'm like, you know what? Instead of sending 50 pages, I'll just send the whole manuscript very passive aggressively. And sure enough, you read the whole thing. And we wound up getting on the phone. I'll never forget it. I was in the parking lot of the gym. It was January. It was cold and rainy. And you gave me these notes and you're like, I think that you need like basically a second narrative. You need like a parallel narrative. Maybe, you know, you were like kind of throwing out suggestions. And then I gasped and I was like, oh! And you said, don't tell me whatever it was that just made you gasp, just do it. And so I did. And that's how we met. And then I sold the book for $100,000.
Yeah. That's one of my favorite stories of my time in the publishing industry.
Yeah, it worked out great for me. Because I went in, I added those additional parallel narratives, and that was it. Like, I really didn't revise so much of the book. I just sort of added to it. And
it sold fast when it went out.
It sold. So I started querying in, like, May, And then the agent that I really wanted, Mandy Hubbard, didn't get back to me until September 30th. She had requested the full quite a bit before that, but she got back to me. She's like, surely you already have representation. And I'm like, I do not, because I really didn't query very widely. I didn't send it out to very many agents. And she was like, well, I absolutely, you know, like, let's roll. And so I was expecting her to have like all these notes, and she really didn't. She suggested a title change, and I liked her suggestion. And like, her notes probably took me maybe 30 minutes to implement. And that was September 30th. And then we went out with it. I said, look, give me a week so I can like read for typos. Like, this is stressing me out. So I read it over and over again for a week. And then we went out, and it sold within the week. So.
And my favorite part about that is, for some reason, were you driving across the country? You came through Madison, and it wasn't very long after. And you hadn't told me that story. And then we sat down for dinner, and you were like, oh, BTW, check this out.
Yes. So that October, I decided to drive across the country. I was doing a lot of stand-up comedy. And so I drove up to Madison, and I was like, this is going to be the best surprise ever. So, like, I'd gone to like a there's a really cool comedy club in Madison, and I'd gone there, and then I left. We met up for dinner, and I was like, guess what? It sold for $100,000, and you gave me the best high five of my life. I'll always, you're like, what? Shut up. That never happens. I'm like, I know. So that was really, really fun. And that was a really fun trip across the country. And that's the only time I've been in Madison, but I loved it. That is a great town.
It is. And I have a picture of us from that night that I will include in the show notes for this episode. You mentioned stand-up comedy, and this is another space where our worlds have had this cool interconnectivity that also is very much in line with Collaborist as a whole.
Yeah.
And that is in 2014, when I was doing volunteer work in all 50 states, I reached out to you to figure out what I was going to do in South Carolina.
Yeah.
And what did you come up with? Because you are the person, like, one of the best things about doing volunteer work is that there were times when I would reach out to people in a state and I would say, I don't have any idea of where I should go or what organization to help. And people would want to do something cool in their community. And maybe the coolest of all of those things is what you came up with.
Well, one thing about me is, like, I don't know how to go small, you know? So I'm always like, what's the biggest thing we can do? And we didn't have a lot of time, because I believe you reached out to me like at the very beginning of March.
That sounds right.
And then I believe that our show was March 30th.
That also sounds right.
Yeah, it was. I knew that I had less than a month. And so I'm like, okay, so obviously we're going to have a stand-up show that's a benefit for the homeless. And you're like, of course. And at that time, Greenville still has, like everywhere in the United States, you know, still has a serious problem with homelessness. But at that time, it was like a real widely discussed thing in the community, because a tent city had cropped up under this bridge, the Pete Hollis Bridge in Greenville, South Carolina. And a good friend of mine, Nick Shaheen, he was like, you know, as comics, we really need to be doing something about this. And so Nick and I had taken to, like, we would go to the store and get a ton of sandwich fixings, make sandwiches, and like go down and help feed the homeless and, or bring them Subway. We just, you know, we didn't really know the best way to help. So we would just do what we could think to do. And so when you suggested that, I'm like, well, this is the perfect opportunity. So anyway, Nick and I, so I recruited Nick and a couple of other comics, Shivani Nataraja and Tom Emmons. And we just jumped on it and put together a pretty good benefit. I can't remember how much we raised. Was it like $2,000?
I don't remember how much we raised. I also want to point out that Elrinthia was there, and Al, that was when I met Al.
Al was the DJ.
Yep. She was. And Al was with us at the Pete Hollis Bridge, yeah, too.
Yes. Al is a photographer, and I remember she had her camera with her.
Yep.
And Al's also just a great person, and she's a great person to have on the team.
Yeah. Well, even the stand-up thing, I'm kind of glad that this is all finding a home to being documented in full with you and me talking about it. Even stand-up. How did you get into stand-up? Because yes, that was another space where
Ben is my fairy godfather in so many ways. So back when I was trying to woo you as my editor of Ruthless, and I was like, you know, because I was really, really hoping I could get the whole manuscript out of you as opposed to just the 50 pages. You had talked about how you were, you know, had always been interested in doing stand-up. Now, at this time in my life, I had done stand-up exactly once, but it had been a competition and I did win. So I had like, for someone who'd only done stand-up once, I had like way too big of a head about it. You know what I mean? Like I thought I was like the bee's knees. Like I knew what I was doing, which I didn't at all, of course. But you said, you know, you were interested in trying stand-up. And I was like, hey, well, if you're ever in town, like I'll take you to the open mic. Like I knew what I was doing. I didn't. I had no clue. I knew about like where the open mic was and blah, blah, blah. So you popped up and you're like, hey, I'm going to be coming through town April 8th or 7th. It was either April 7th or April 8th. I think it was April 8th. And this was in January. That was that same conversation when I was in the parking lot of the gym. And you're like, I'm going to be coming through town and I want to do stand up. And I was like, oh, he's calling my bluff. Oh, no.
And for clarity's sake, this is a year or two before we did the actual benefit. This was a time when I was supposed to be coming to South Carolina, ultimately didn't make it on that trip.
This is January of 2013. So January 2013, you know, I get the notes from Ruthless, and in the same conversation, you're like, guess what? I'm coming through Greenville, April 8th. And I was like, oh no, like my card has just been pulled. And I immediately concluded that the only rational way to handle this is to go to every single available open mic from January to April 8th. Because I'm like, by the time he gets here April 8th, I will look like one of the regulars. And I know that I will like weasel my way into this community and like find a way for them to like accept me by April 8th. And I'll at least know something of what I'm doing. And that's exactly what I did. So I started going to comedy. And like the first time I got on stage, I died 1,000 deaths. It was so horrible. And I remember all the regular comics were like, ugh, she's not funny. And, you know, I was just rejected. But I was also very, very determined because I was like, I know that I'm funnier than that. I know I can do better than that. And I did. I went to every single available open mic between, I believe it was January 21st and April 8th. So April 8th comes around. My dad has since passed, but my mom still has a CPA firm. And I was working tax season. It was April 8th. I was all excited. I was like, Ben's going to come into town and I'm going to look like I know what I'm doing. We're going to go to this open mic and it's going to be great. And I get a message from you and you're like, where are you? And I'm like, I'm in Greenville. And you're like, well, what Greenville? I'm in Greenville, South Carolina. And you're like, oh no, I am in Greenville, North Carolina.
geography.
And I was like, oh, but you know what though? Like I, you know, of course I went to the open mic like I did every Monday by that point. And I realized like you had been the impetus to get me started on stand-up. By that point, I wasn't even that disappointed is what I'm trying to get at. Cause I was like, well, who cares? I still am going to go to comedy tonight and I love it. And it had been the thing that I needed to kick me into gear and to do the thing that I've been dreaming of doing for years and years and years. And like, once I had the determination to really dedicate myself to it, I became completely addicted to stand-up. And I I gave it most of my, all of my time and attention in life for years and years. And I really came to love producing shows and hosting shows. That's really my wheelhouse. I'm an okay comic doing time, but producing and producing and hosting is really my jam.
Is the last time I saw you at the release party for Ruthless?
Yes, that was awesome.
I was on my way to Atlanta because I was leaving to go to South Africa. And I didn't tell you, but I just showed up.
Yes, that was the coolest thing. So again, so for my the release party of Ruthless, this was July 18th, 2015. I decided to have like a great big party at a brewery because why not? And it was sort of like a book release party slash a wedding because there was a lot of dancing. Again, Al was the DJ, mm-hmm. and it was a great party. Like there was a food truck, we had Southern barbecue, blah blah blah, and it had a great turnout, and it was tons of fun. And I'm signing books. And I look up and you're the next person in line. And I threw a pin at you because I was like, what?
And I have that on video. I'll include that in the show notes. I didn't realize that I have a lot of multimedia to support this. Maybe I'll even put up my little highlight from my stand-up set that I did at the...
I still feel so guilty about that because I was worried about you because you had never done stand up before. So I was like putting pressure on you to like do as little time as possible. And then you get up and you do stand up and you are one of the best of the night. And I'm like, I died 1,000 deaths because I'm like, Carrie, you should have had more faith in Ben. And you did so well and the people loved you and you got a lot of great laughs. And I hated it because I'm like, man, you should have been on stage longer.
Well, my favorite part of that, and I tell this story, and I love telling this story, is that I drove to South Carolina, and the whole time I was driving down, I was working on whatever my set, my routine was going to be, and so I was like just talking to myself the whole time down, recording, and I come up with this set and I'm like, oh, this is going to be so great and so hilarious. And I'm like workshopping it with friends as I'm driving. I'm calling people and being like, okay, check this out. And I was never going to be, like Richard Pryor. I was never going to be like working like a dirty comic. Yeah. But I'm me, so there was going to be a little bit of edge to it. And we were talking, like, in my head, this story is, like, 10 minutes before I'm going to go on. You're like, oh, hey, by the way, this is, like, kind of a pretty Catholic audience. And, you know, just so you know. And I was like, oh, I think what she's saying is probably don't go as edgy as you might be. So then... I'm like scrambling in those 10 minutes, being like, okay, cut this whole thing, stitch this together, try to make this make sense. Okay, if I pull on this thread, what happens over here? And so I had to kind of cobble it together and do the go with God thing because I was like, either this is going to work or it's going to be a colossal train wreck. But
I hate this story so much. This is not an example of me being a good producer.
But the thing is,
I am a good comedy producer. Not right now. Not in this story.
But the thing is, I still know how I was going to open the set. And and I dream about someday being like, okay, here's the director's cut. Let me go ahead and do this again.
I can always do another benefit. I have a April 1st, I have a hosting gig. It's very rare for me to get out and do comedy these days because of children. It's hard to get childcare at night. And I'm so excited that I'm so excited to get back on stage. Once my life gets to a point where I can like get more childcare more regularly, like I'm gonna be right back in there.
All right,
very
I'll amazing. Show up. You're gonna be calling people to this stage, and you'll be like, Neb Yorl. This name sounds familiar. And then you'll be, oh my God, it's Ben Leroy. He's doing this thing where he just shows up. And I'm gonna grab the microphone. I'm gonna be like, if you are a prude, if you are not willing to hear some PG-13 material, then I suggest you either plug your ears or you get out of here, because I'm gonna let it rip.
I can do another homeless benefit. That's not a problem that's going away anytime soon. We can work on that forever.
Yeah. How did you become a storyteller?
I definitely know I was influenced by my dad and my dad's mother, who we called Granny. They were both exceptional storytellers. And my dad was a profoundly funny person. And he had an incredible gift for punchlines, which I unfortunately did not inherit. So I know that I was very influenced by them and by that side of my family. My grandmother was famous for her ghost stories, all of which were true ghost stories from my granny. But you know, it's kind of interesting because as a kid, I really, really, really identified as an artist. I thought that I wanted to be a painter when I grew up, and I was very focused on drawing and painting. And I remember vividly we wrote like little books in the second grade. And I remember being really proud of what I had written. And I remember we got to read them aloud. And I remember my classmates really liked my story. By the way, the story is essentially Ruthless.
Fascinating.
Hilarious to me, because I'm like, I only got the one trick, you guys. It's about a girl getting chased. It's essentially the same thing. It's just a supernatural bad guy instead of a serial killer. But so I had had this like this notion of myself as a visual artist, and then like when I got into high school, I became aware of my limitations as a visual artist. And it really bothered me. And I knew that I was never going to be great. And I kind of made this conscious choice that I needed to shift to storytelling, because it was the other thing that I did. And I felt like it was something that if I worked hard at it, I could become better at storytelling than I had been at painting and drawing. And so that had been like the story that I told myself for a really long time. And then somewhere like in my 20s, my parents moved, and I sort of inherited all of my childhood belongings. And I was going through all these boxes of stuff. And I was shocked to find it was just chock full of stories. And I never thought of myself as someone who had spent a lot of time writing stories as a kid, but I did. And I kept all of them. And as I found all these things I'd written, I remembered writing them. And I remembered, I don't know, it's sort of weird. So it's like the story that I told myself about myself really wasn't accurate. Like, even though like I've worked on drawing and painting almost every single day and kind of obsessively, so it was like a big part of my time, I also was spending a lot of time just sitting down and writing out these multi-chapter stories. But the one thing that I do know for sure is that around ninth grade, well, actually there was a real turning point, and it was, I went to go see Silence of the Lambs, and I saw it 3 times in the theater. And for the first time, I really noticed the screenplay credit. There's a screenplay by Ted Talley. And I thought, I had always had, like, as a small child, I'd had this notion that filmmakers were all like Woody Allen, that everyone was like an auteur, that they wrote the screenplay and then they directed the movie. And I didn't have any desire to be a director, but I liked the idea of writing screenplays. And when I saw Silence of the Lambs, I was obsessed with the movie. And I also had this epiphany that you could just be a screenwriter. You didn't have to be a director. Like, you could just be behind the scenes and write. And I was like, that sounds phenomenal. Like, that's what I want to do, because screenwriting combines storytelling with visuals. And I wasn't a talented enough visual artist to convey what I wanted to, but I could write those visuals.
Can I stop you like right there? Because that's a fascinating thing to me. I have zero ability to draw or paint. And when I say that, I mean in a way that I cannot take what is in my brain and translate it to canvas. I'm incapable of doing that with my current skill set.
Yeah.
And I know that because the absence of a natural inclination to do that is so obvious. But what was that like as someone who did have the skill set and did practice it, and having the, I would assume, frustration of seeing something in your mind that you can't quite translate into being?
It was depressing. I'd had a sort of a similar experience with playing the piano. I was pretty good, but I realized that I was never going to be great, and that was disappointing, you know? But the visual artist part of me was literally depressing. That was like in like kind of eighth and ninth grade that I was just sort of coming to this awareness that I wasn't as good as I wanted to be. And I really didn't think that I was ever going to be able to become, you know, like great at it. And so it was literally depressing. But I pretty quickly made just that conscious choice to switch my energy into storytelling, into writing, because for whatever reason, it just felt to me that if I applied myself and worked hard at that, I could get much, much better at that. And so there was like a definitely like a little bit of a mourning period. Cause like, as a kid, I used to like research like the Chicago Institute of Art. And these are the places that I thought that I was going to like go to college as a little kid. And then I realized like it wasn't going to happen for me. I would imagine that lots and lots of kids will have that sort of an experience as an athlete. You know, there's, you know, people who are very good at high school ball, but they realize they're not going to cut it in college or the NFL or, you know, whatever.
Right. Yeah.
So I would imagine that's a pretty common experience for student athletes. And I think it was probably pretty similar for me as an artist.
Continue on with your journey from there to here today.
Well, so, you know, once I had my epiphany of Silence of the Lambs, I became completely obsessed with becoming a screenwriter. And again, it's one of those things where I like found evidence, like, you know, I've kept a lot of stuff from when I was a kid, and like, I'll see these notes from teachers who are like, listen, if you ever want to like be a screenwriter, you better do this. You know what I mean? Like they obviously, I talked my head off to anyone who would listen about how I wanted to be a screenwriter, because like everybody knew about it. I don't remember doing that, but obviously I must have. But I will tell you that I was mostly a good student. I really, if I had a teacher that I did not like, if I had a teacher who I felt like was full of BS, I was, you know, I could be a real thorn in their side. I sort of struggled with authority. And I really, really struggled with math. And I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that I have a learning disability when it comes to math. And so like, you know, when I was a senior in high school, I was like in algebra with a whole bunch of ninth graders. It was like just me and those kids, and those ninth graders felt bad about the fact they were in algebra. I'm like, how do you think I feel, man? I'm a senior in high school and I still can't figure it out. And so I really didn't have a very good GPA. And I went to my guidance counselor, Mr. Bean. That was his, like, I'm not afraid to call that man out. He's if Mr. Bean is still out there. I went to Mr. Bean and I told him that I wanted to go to USC Film School, and I was just singularly focused in that goal. That was my dream of dreams. Cause like NYU was nothing but productions. Like, they're gearing you up to be a director, and I didn't want that. And UCLA didn't have a designated writing program. USC Film School was the number one film school in the country, and it was the only one that had an undergrad writing program. It was a 4-year program of just cinematic writing. And so it was perfect. It was exactly what I wanted. And I told Mr. Bean that that was my dream and my goal. And he looked at me and he goes, "Carrie, only good students get into USC."
Ouch.
And I was just like, I will set you on fire with my eyes. And so I didn't let that dissuade me. And I went to apply, and they also had a bare minimum SAT to get into USC, and my SAT was below that. So there wasn't a whole lot of reason for me to hope that I would get into USC. And my parents were really, really, really financially struggling at this point in time, like really, really struggling. And the cost of the application was $50. And my mom was like, "I'm not going to spend $50 on nothing, Carrie. I'm not doing it." And so my sister, Becky, who was a single mom at the time, and she had very, very, very little money herself, she gave me the $50. That makes me want to cry.
Yeah.
Oh, I hate emotions. Ick. Anyway, so I applied and I got in. And it was really cool because, you know, fewer than 7% of people got in. It was a really small percentage of people. And the freshman class is only 24 kids. And it was really cool. I'll never forget it. Like getting the phone call April 13th of 95. And oh man, I can't tell you how excited I was to go to school and find Mr. Bean. And I was like, "Guess what, Mr. Bean?" Guess what?
By your logic, you're looking at a real good student.
Yeah. And actually, he was not classy about it at all, because I was with a friend, Nathan Spencer, and he had just gotten into the University of Puget Sound. And so he was like, "Hey, Mr. Bean, guess what? I just got into UPS." And we liked to joke that their colors were brown and gold. And Mr. Bean was like, "Oh, Nathan, I'm not surprised. I'm so proud of you. That's so wonderful, Nathan, blah, 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 blah." And I'm right there and I go, "And guess what? I got into USC Film School." And he goes, "Oh." And he turned around and walked away.
Oh, Mr. Bean.
Mr. Bean. But like, and I love films. I love film school. It was a very, very great experience. And like I said, there was 24 kids. It was very strongly male. There was very few female students. And the female students that were there dropped out so fast. It was like flies. Because it was competitive. A lot of the students were mean, and it was a harsh environment. It was a very, you know, it was mean. It was a real,
it wasn't support. Like, there was no camaraderie, or were there cliques? Like, what, how did that?
It was like cliques. It was like a really mean family, because we call ourselves the Den of Vipers. So if that gives you an idea of the,
yeah,
of the vibe, It was very, very competitive. It was very, a lot of very mean and funny people who were very talented and were not kind to the people who were not talented. And it was just a real Darwinistic kind of a thing. And people just, I mean, girls and like men and women both dropped out, but by the end there was only 4 women who graduated. So it was a real attrition situation. It was a real battle of attrition. But like, I remember one time we also had all of our classes together. So we had film classes, but then we also had like electives that we were like forced to take, essentially. It was very prescriptive. And we had very, very few electives that were like genuinely electives, like just for, you know, that we could do whatever the heck we actually wanted. And because I'm a nerd, I took nothing but classes in Eastern European history and East Asian studies. I graduated with like minors in both of those because that's how much of a nerd I am. We had all of our classes together. So it's like, there was like Western Civilization 1 and 2 for everybody. And then Western Civilization 1 and 2 for the filmic writers. So like, it was this very kind of incestuous, like family thing. And it was also a weird thing to do for 18-year-olds, because I think you can gather by what I just said, we were made to feel like we were very special. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, if everybody else has to do Western Civ 1 and 2, but then we get our very own history professor to teach just us. In retrospect, I still wonder, like, what the hell's up with that? That's so weird. Like, why? Like, I don't even know why that happened. But it was like that in our history classes, our humanities classes were just for us. So it was a very close family, but it was very infighty and, you know, whatever. I loved it. I mean, like, I don't think that I was so sharky myself, but I'm not gonna sit here and pretend otherwise. I enjoyed the whole thing. I liked it. There was this, I remember one time we had this production class, and this guy had completely phoned it in. Like he just had made the laziest short film that he possibly could. Like, it was so lazy, you know, like, and all of us are out there like doing our best, like giving it everything we've got to make the absolute best short film that we can. And like, when somebody would come in with just something thrown together that they obviously didn't give a crap about, like, they would just get destroyed. And I remember my friend Aaron Schimberg said, like, he raised his hand so hard and the teacher called on him and he goes, "How long was that?" And the guy goes, "It was 2 minutes and 43 seconds." And he goes, "It was 2 minutes and 43 seconds too long." And it was, because it was like, you know, it was a lazy POS thing you'd phoned in. And like the vast majority of people who were in there really wanted it. And so it was almost like an insult to the people who tried so hard to get in and didn't. You know, do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, anyway, it was overall, it was a really good experience. But the one thing about film school is that it gave all of us, like, it turned all of us into like essentially like heat seeking missiles, you know, in that we felt like if we didn't succeed in Hollywood, we were going to be just enormous failures for the rest of our lives. Like, do you know what I'm saying? Like, there was like this very big burden of expectation and ambition. And many of the people in my class succeeded hugely. The class of 1999 became the most successful class that USC has ever put out. It was kind of hard for the first couple of years to watch my classmates have such enormous successes, but it also taught me really, really, really quick that you have to root for your friends. And that is the only way to stay sane. You know, like, you have, like, if you, like, jealousy will drive you crazy. You know what I mean? And the cure for jealousy is to be the biggest and best cheerleader out there. And I'm really grateful for that lesson, because it's something that I learned early, and I learned it well. And I just, whenever I see like groups of creative people who are in that competitive space of hierarchy and trying to figure out who's the best, I hate it. I really hate that energy, because it is so much better to be in a collaborative space where you're rooting for everyone. Like, whether it's stand-up comedy or people writing novels, like, you've got to be a cheerleader instead of a saboteur.
I love hearing you say that. And I wanted to know about your philosophy. You are leading one of the first collaborist writers groups.
Yes.
How much of that cheerleader part is going in? Because I'm assuming you're not creating a clicky situation of Lord of the Flies writers yes. group.
Yes.
What lessons do you bring to group dynamics as part of the leading of a writer's group?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I haven't ever led a writing group like this. You know, I haven't, we're working on character and dialogue. We have a sort of a pretty close focus on improving our skills in that situation. And I haven't ever taught exactly this, so I'm excited to teach it because I have a lot of writing exercises that I can't wait for them to do it. I'm so excited about the curriculum. But I've certainly led a lot of writing groups in terms of stand-ups, working on jokes, and also in terms of novelists sharing critiques of, you know, full-fledged novels. And you got to lead by example, basically. And so, you know, I think that when you're leading a writing group, it's so important the tone that you set, and that I think that people pretty quickly catch up on the vibe that we're not going to have any clicky mean girl or mean guy kind of energy. Like, cause I won't stand for it. Like I absolutely won't. And in part because of what I saw in film school, you know what I mean? Like that left a really big mark on me. And even though I was able to live, I was able to handle that kind of withering criticism. I watched what it did to all those people who dropped out, and it was a large number of people. And so when I joined the Greenville comedy scene, it was that same kind of film school energy. Actually, I'm going to be completely honest with you. Okay. So it was the same kind of thing, starting to do stand-up. It was very much like getting hazed. It was like joining a fraternity, you know, and the people were mean to you, and it was tough to like be there and like live through it. But, you know, I was determined, and I eventually was like welcomed into the group. And once I was like welcomed into the group, I made it a point to change the culture of my scene, of my comedy scene. And I know some people may be rolling their eyes, like, you know, people that I know personally, because like, I don't know if I deserve so much credit that I'm giving myself right now, but I do believe that I had a big role to play in changing the culture of the comedy scene when I was kind of running the show, because I produced an awful lot of comedy for a long time. And you know what, Ben? It wasn't 100% all for the best. Because what I realized is that when I had started and everybody was so mean, it did kind of separate the wheat from the chaff. Isn't that horrible? But it was kind of like, it's kind of true. Like the people who really wanted it, like stayed through the hazing. And nobody needs to be like hazed brutally, you know, but I actually feel like I softened it a little bit too much. And so I think I got a little bit too much of just everybody shaking pom poms and not enough like honest feedback. And that was one of the things that I stressed in the session yesterday in our writing group, is the importance of being honest in our feedback, always respectful and always kind, but also having the courage to be honest, and also having the courage to not treat your writing as being so precious that it can't be commented upon. Does that make sense?
It absolutely does. And I can say from experience that you live that out, even back when I gave you notes on Ruthless originally, is you didn't, we had a respectful and compassionate environment with the shared goal of making the book better. And yes. If you can internalize other people's motivations is coming from a good place and a helpful place, it's a lot easier to objectively look at your own material and say, oh, yeah, maybe they're right. Because you're not feeling attacked. You're not spending your time defending against attack.
Yes.
You are being part of a collaborative environment that is examining where something can be strengthened and how to strengthen it. And it's about having that conversation. And that's one of the joys of editing, is that you can point out where something doesn't work for you as a reader. And you might have ideas about how the author might address and fix it. But just the act of telling the author that something doesn't work allows their own creativity and problem solving to get engaged and figure out how to address something.
Yes. And isn't it exciting as an editor when you point something out, particularly when I find it particularly satisfying when I see something where I'm not sure like how to fix it. I'm a little bit at a loss as to, you know, what is going to fix this situation, but this is definitely not clicking. And then the writer goes back and works on it and submits something, you know, you get the fix and it's something wildly different than what you would have ever anticipated. And exactly. It solves the problem beautifully. And you're like, holy cow, look at this. That is such a great moment.
It really is. It makes it all worth it. And it makes you feel, as an editor, really and truly part of the creative process.
Yeah.
And that what a sacred honor to sort of help be a guardian and yes. stewardship over helping people tell a story.
Yes. Yeah. I have been very, very fortunate with my editorial clients. I've really come to love all the people that I've worked with, you know, because, you know, part of it's, you know, especially when I can't think of, that's not true. I can think of one example. There was once upon a time where I've edited like some nonfiction, like sort of almost like business manual kind of things that were different, you know, like that was a very different beast. And, I'm not going to do that anymore, Ben. That was not fun. I'm not doing that anymore. But every single time that I've worked on a piece of not of fiction or memoir, it's such a blessing to like have someone entrust their story to you, you know, like, 'cause they are giving you their heart. And it is a very, very sacred duty, I think, to read people's work and to just handle it with care, but also with honesty.
Yeah, it's the compassionate thing that you can do to truly and genuinely help people. Yep. If people are interested in joining your group for the current session, even though it's begun, is there a way for them to get in, or would you prefer that they wait until you run your next group? What's the best way for people who might be interested?
If people wanted, I think that I'm going to shut it down. Like there's three more slots available. So there is a little bit more space. We currently have 5 people and I had set the cap at 8. And so if somebody were to join just like in this next week or two, that would be fine. But after that point, I'm going to shut it down. And I'm going to hopefully do the same thing. This character and dialogue is set to run for the next 6 months. We meet biweekly. And after, you know, I would say, let's say April 8th. After April 8th, I'll just shut it down and say, come back around in 6 months and we'll start over.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me. I cried, Ben.
I know. I kind of got a little emotional hearing you get emotional, which is like the ultimate human thing.
Yes. I'm not one to cry very often. So it's sort of crazy.
Yeah. This may be the first time that I've actually been witness to it in any way.
Yeah. I'm not a crier, but that one got me. All right. Well, thank you so much for having me.
thank you for being a part of Collaborist. It's been wonderful knowing that I've got relationships with such wonderful people who are genuinely concerned about their community and concerned about helping people tell stories. In fact, before I let you go, can you tell me about the charity that you selected to support as part of Collaborist?
Oh, thank you for asking me about that. So I chose St. Anthony's of Padua Catholic School. And I know that that might sound odd to choose a Catholic school because the vast majority of private schools are expensive and people with plenty of money send their kids to them. And, you know, it's, for lack of a better word, maybe, you know, elitist, and private schools are elitist. But St. Anthony's of Padua is a completely different scenario. It is a school that serves the under-supported community of Greenville, and even the wider beyond Greenville. There's a lot of parents who drive a long ways to get their kids into St. Anthony's. Demographically, it is predominantly a Black school. St. Anthony's of Padua is a Black Catholic parish, which is, a lot of people are like, what, that exists? And yes, it does. And it is a predominantly Black school and Hispanic. And I think it's only like 7% white. And it is a wonderful school. They teach these kids not just the things that you would expect a school to teach kids, that also they learn these wonderful affirmations, and they learn how to embrace their own power, and they learn how to be leaders in their community. And St. Anthony's of Padua has done such an exceptional job of producing incredible leaders. Like, for example, the youngest judge in the history of the United States is an alumnus of St. Anthony's. And it goes on. They actually have a special talent for producing judges, by the way. I'm not really sure what's up with that, but definitely the fact that they're really into social justice and teaching justice at St. Anthony's probably leads to them producing a lot of judges, a lot of lawyers. And I just love it. They have like a community garden. The kids learn how to cook. They have like a kitchen. It's just, they do martial arts. Like, it's so much fun. They still play dodgeball.
All right.
Then they play dodgeball. Like, you know what I mean? Like, they're just having fun. Like, it's a good time. And, you know, the kids who attend, more than 90% of them cannot afford tuition. And so it is all subsidized by outside donations. And so that is my cause. My charity is to raise money so that more kids can go to St. Anthony's and get a really high quality education and break the cycle of poverty.
Excellent. And just to reiterate how that all comes together, if people wish to work with Carrie as an editor or a ghostwriter and there's a good fit for the project, direct donations to St. Anthony's will be taken from the overall fee of working with Carrie as part of our making sure to support organizations that are building community and helping out in the world. I want to thank you again, dear friend, for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you, Fairy Godfather Ben.
Okay, I will talk to you soon.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks very much to Carrie/Carolyn for taking her time to chat, and for you for being able to catch her in her busy schedule and sit down and make her cry.
Yeah, I'm kind of a jerk.
Like I said, I really enjoyed listening to this conversation because I think it highlights so much of what you and I are trying to do with Collaborist. The junction of storytelling and community, we say that a lot. We feel it, but it can be a little abstract. And to hear this story and to think about the connections between your friend who needed the surgery and you offering to do the review for somebody who could come up with the funds for that, and then her attempts to do that, and then and going back to her sister giving her that application fee money, and then out of this has come, you know, her novel, her going to USC, and I know that, you know, you went to Greenville and met her and had a whole set of experiences around community there, right?
Yeah, that was an awesome time. And as we talked about in the interview, it was the one and only set of stand-up comedy that I've done. And I'm, as of this recording, I'm 95% sure I'm going to put a link to the video where I got up there and did the thing. There's a heckler. There's a heckler that pops up right in the middle of my set. And for a second, I froze because I was like, wait, why is someone doing that? And then I was like, oh, I'm just going to keep going. And then the other thing, I would actually, this is kind of an interesting confession here, I actually would have shared this stand-up comedy routine more often. I haven't like hidden it, but I would have shared it more often, except at one point, the wrong word gets lodged in my brain that's part of a punchline. And as I was delivering it, I was very aware that the word I was saying was not the word I was looking for. But I also knew that I couldn't stop and like, oh, what's the word I'm looking for? So I just said a word that I was like, this is in the same ballpark, I guess, of what it is I'm trying to say. But every time I hear it, and I'll let people, if you know what the secret word is and you send an email to info@Collaborist, I'll give you $1 off any service of your choice. But there's one word where I'm like, oh no. And that's what ruins that set for me. I also found, I mentioned that when I got to the place where we were doing the benefit, I was locked into what my routine was going to be. And then Carrie came in and she's like, hey, just so you know, it's like a really Catholic audience and it skews a little bit older. And I was like, oh. And so I started cutting up my routine. But I did find when I was going through the archives yesterday, I have all of the stuff that I've ever recorded or ever taken a picture of. I'm a pack rat that way. I did find from the hotel ahead of time, I performed the routine for the camera and I did do the full beginning that I wanted to do. So I might splice that in somehow and like, just so you know, like I could have been funny if I would have just had the full range of my comedic grab bag. But yeah, thank you, Carrie, for coming on the podcast. For those of you who are intrigued and feel like she might be a good fit for your own writing journey, she is both available for hire as an editor and as a ghostwriter, but she's also leading a writer's group for free. Just go to collaborist.org, go to the group section, and you will see how to sign up.
And if that fills up, she'll be doing it again sometime down the line. These are going to be recurring, not immediately afterwards, but there will be further opportunities. And there are other groups too, led by people who are equally compelling and interesting in their own ways.
Indeed. So, Sarah J. Henry, Ted Flanagan, yours truly, John Vercher. We've got variety out there. We've got a variety of things. And once Jason gets done having to manage sick kids and new couch, he'll have his own group. I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to be in that group too.
All right.
All right. Well, if you enjoyed listening to Collaboracast, please remember to rate and review wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on all of the social medias. That does not include Facebook. Also, you can't find our podcast on Spotify, or if you can, it's not because we put it there. So I kind of just told you to go everywhere, but there are some places where it doesn't do you any good to go. We'll see you next Wednesday. Big thanks to Self Help for the intro and outro music. Mr. Jason, I will speak with you later.
Sounds like a plan. For story.
For community.
Collaborist.